Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Today's guest is Michael J. Morris, a consulting astrologer and tarot reader, artist, writer, teacher, facilitator, and witch committed to personal and collective healing and liberation. They began their consulting practice, Co-Witchcraft Offerings, in 2019, through which they share astrology, tarot, and movement ritual practices. Michael holds a PhD in dance studies and brings decades of experience in dance, yoga, Reiki, and other somatic practices to their work. They are a queer feminist, and their practices are inspired and informed by years of study and teaching in feminism, queer studies, gender and sexuality studies, environmental studies, and other branches of critical theory. Michael has presented at the Queer Astrology Conference 2020, the 2020 Fresh Voices in Astrology Summit, the Astrology and Climate Change Conference, NORWAC 2022, and the 54th Annual Conference of the Astrological Association. They are a teaching assistant with Kelly Surtees of Kelly's Astrology, a contributing writer to the Chani app, and a guest teacher in the Foundation's An Embodied Ancestral Inquiry course presented by Wild Body Somatics. They reside in Columbus, Ohio, the ancestral and contemporary territory of the Shawnee, Potawatomi, Delaware, Miami, Peoria, Seneca, Wyandotte, Ojibwe, and Cherokee peoples.
Well, first, thank you so much for inviting me into this conversation with you. And in terms of who I am and where I am, well, I just came from facilitating a workshop about LGBTQ histories and inclusive pedagogies and embodying more possibilities for who we can become. So in this moment, I'm feeling very aware of myself as a process of becoming. The parts of myself that exceed identification and even language, my queerness, and the ways that my life is made possible by all of the queer and transcestors who came before and live into this moment through me and you. And in terms of where, I am in Columbus, Ohio, in the so-called United States, which are the ancestral and contemporary territories of the Shawnee, the Potawatomi, the Delaware, the Miami, the Peoria, the Seneca, the Wyandotte, the Ojibwe, and the Cherokee peoples. And I'm in my home, and I am looking out the window at the park across the street, which is a piece of land that I've had a long and deep relationship with. It's been raining most of the day, and the rain has stopped for a moment. So there's like a calmness in the air as the sun is approaching sunset.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much for really being so present. Sometimes I think that question can be the hardest one for people actually to just kind of land, you know, so I really appreciate that. And I also really love that you said the word becoming as how you feel to be, because that's something that's really been on my mind lately in describing myself and resisting the urge to ever describe myself as being like arrived or finished or in any kind of like fixed identity. And I agree with you that like that's something that queer people especially can access maybe more readily, but still, I think, at least speaking for myself, it can still be hard for me to live in that place of, you know, becoming. So I really appreciate that you brought that in.
Yeah. I mean, I think, to that point, yes, queer people, perhaps we have more access to that in certain ways, or that awareness in certain ways, because most of us have gone through some process of becoming something or someone different from who we thought ourselves to be, or becoming someone more than we were told we could be. So like having gone through an experience of the world told me that I was this, maybe even I thought of myself in those ways, And then through some kind of exploration of my own desires or my own awareness of sense of self, felt sense, I became someone else, someone different, someone more. I think this is true of all experience. All things, all people are in processes of becoming. I mean, not to jump ahead, but I think that that's something that astrology teaches us as well, that we are all in these processes of becoming. But of course, we're living in cultures, many of us are living in cultures that do try to fix us with certain definitions or categories or identities even. Like actually part of what I shared in the workshop this afternoon was some thinking from Marquise Bay, who wrote a book called Black Trans Feminism. And one of the things that they point to in that book is that if we're truly invested in freedom, in liberation, then that's going to require us to let go of even the things with which we trap ourselves, with which we capture ourselves, the familiar identities that perhaps we even have come to love. I love being fill in the blank. And yet, if we're truly moving toward freedom, then in what ways might we be asked or called to exceed even those familiar, beloved categories, identities, et cetera? So that's very much on my mind right now.
I can't resist jumping ahead, actually, because that what you just said like really takes me there. So I'm thrilled that you're here. You know, you are a multi-hyphenate, just like everyone that comes on the podcast and really just like everyone in the world, I think. You know, we're all many things, you know. So you're an astrologer, you're a tarot reader, you have a dance background. We both share that, and many other amazing things. So yeah, so I can't resist kind of jumping into astrology with you on that topic because I'm curious about your experience working in modalities that rely on archetype to source their meaning. And what you just said, I resonate so much with that, of that sometimes I even love these identities that I take on and these labels that I take on, and they give me a sense of community and a sense of belonging. And it's, I think it can be said very much like that about these archetypes. You know, I might love the way that maybe I love the way Jupiter often gets talked about, or I really love the Queen of Cups card and the way that gets talked about. But you know, what is in that for you around that lesson of constant becoming when it comes to these kind of mythical esoteric archetypes?
That's a great question. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that whatever we might think of as an archetype takes on instantiation in particularity, in particular situations in tarot, in the context of a particular question, but also in the particularities of a specific deck. Like I'm actually, part of how I read tarot is I don't know if I think there is an archetype of the Eight of Wands, for example. It's like, if we go far enough back, there's no commonality in the image of the card itself. And so my approach to reading tarot increasingly over the last 20 years has been engaging with the image itself. What is shown in this particular card? And so there's a particularity even in the archetypal. We never encounter the archetype in a vacuum or in its unattached or unrelated form. And that's true of astrology as well. When I work with a chart, when I'm working with my own chart, but especially when I'm working with clients, I am bringing some understanding of these astrological archetypes in terms of the planets, the signs, the houses. I work a lot with the asteroids as well. And so a lot of myth comes in that way. But I'm coming in very clear that I don't yet know what this is going to mean for the person I'm with until I hear how those qualities or forces articulate themselves in that person's lived experience. So whether I'm working with tarot or astrology, I'm very interested in the specificity, the particularity, the nuance of how what we might think of as archetypes becomes articulate in these specific contexts, these specific lived experiences. Who is it that I'm with? What is the question that we ask? The same card will mean something totally different depending on what question we asked in terms of tarot, I mean. At least for me, at least that's the way that I approach reading tarot. It's like, yeah, I think I'm thinking about one of the decks that I read with the most is Rachel Pollack's Shining Tribe Tarot. And in that deck, she replaces the Hierophant card with a card called Tradition. And in the Tradition card, there's a circle of stones. There's a series of kind of glowing pathways making their way into the stones. And then in the center of the stone, there's a flower blossoming. There's more going on in the card, but that's enough for people listening to get some kind of image. Mm-hmm. If I asked a question about, I don't know, relocating or like moving somewhere, I don't know. That card has like some rocks and it has a flower that's put down roots. That doesn't feel like moving somewhere, for example. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, that card takes on a meaning that's very specific to the question that we asked. But if I was asking a question about how do I connect with my ancestors, for example, that same card, that same image offers a very different perspective than you should stay where you are. The card doesn't say that in that context because that's not the question we asked. Does that make sense a little bit?
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and astrology, I think astrology functions very much the same way, that I can have an idea of how the sun in Aries right now, what that might show up for, how that might show up in a person's life. But it's not until I'm in conversation with them or reading their memoir or biography that I come to understand how that particular configuration is showing up in that unique lived experience. That's the first thing that comes to mind. I probably have some more thoughts in that direction, but yeah, let's see where that takes us.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I'm curious, how that, as you were learning, which, you know, we can kind of start to go backwards, to go forwards a little bit with, you know, how you learned astrology and tarot. But, you know, I'll speak for myself that, you know, first I came into a relationship with the archetypes and the cards and the planets, like on my own, and then mm-hmm. starting to think about how it, you know, how I want to work with other people through those modalities. So what was that process like for you? Because I feel like people who are listening, a lot of people who are listening may be in that place of starting to read for others, you know, and a lot of times we develop very close personal relationships with these energies or, you know, these images and ideas. And then how do you go about expanding beyond that and, you know, learning how to take in other people's perspectives, like you're saying, in stories and weave those in as well?
It's going to be different a little in the tarot journey and the astrology journey. I started reading tarot first. I've been reading tarot for, well, a little over 20 years now, about as long as I've been a witch, and a little less time than I've been a dancer. You know, so then it's like looking back at that person, this teenager who was looking for something, and I encountered tarot, I guess, along my journey into witchcraft, which, like, I guess some of the context there is that I was raised in a very conservative evangelical Christian family in Louisiana, in the deep South in the US, and then went to college at a Christian university in Mississippi, also in the deep South. And it was during that first year of college that I started to come to terms with my own queerness, and also started to explore more. But actually, that's not even the full story, because the search for witchcraft really started in high school, but it was very hidden at that point. It was in the stacks of libraries, the public library, or on the dial-up internet when no one was home, or in my bedroom late at night with the door closed. And I think when I look back at that period now and try to understand, like, what was I looking for? Why was this kid who had been raised Christian looking for witchcraft? And I think it's because I already, even before I came to terms with my queerness, I had a deep sense of being forbidden. And I think I went in search of belonging in the other forbidden places, and witchcraft was one of the places that presented itself. So then that's part of the start of my tarot journey, is going to college, first year of a dance program, getting a BFA in dance, and stumbling or finding my way into this little metaphysical bookshop, little metaphysical store in the Arts District of Jackson, Mississippi, that was called New Vibrations. And that's where I started learning tarot and learning about crystals and connecting with rocks and studying goddess spiritualities. And so it was in that context that I first began engaging with the cards, of like, I'm looking for a place to belong. I'm looking for some sort of reflection of myself. But also, like, I was a teenager, so I was like very connected to what the book told me the cards meant in those early days. But fairly quickly, that started to shift to, especially when I started reading with multiple decks and realizing the same, the High Priestess in one deck is not the same card as a High Priestess in another deck. And that was, that illustrated something really important to me. And I started engaging with tarot, the archetypes of tarot, more in that particularity that it was pointing to, that's actually not very different from how I was looking at art or looking at dance. I come from this background of really prioritizing what is it that you are actually witnessing in front of you, rather than, in the context of interpreting dance, for example, rather than superimposing or projecting a meaning onto the dance. It's like, how does the dance articulate its meaning through its formal characteristics, through its movement vocabulary, through its composition and syntax, how that vocabulary is put together, through its stylistic decisions, things like that. And I don't think I was aware of this in those early years, but I started reading tarot in a very similar way. Like, what are the formal characteristics that I see in the card? And what does that tell me about the meaning of the card in this context, in the context of the question? In terms of my evolving relationship with the archetypes of astrology, I encountered astrology around that same time, but I didn't go deeply into it. Like, I know I got my first like used astrology books while I was living in Jackson, but I didn't see my chart for the first time until 2014. So whatever I was doing with astrology at that point was very detached or symbolic in some way. I wasn't actually thinking about it in relation to me yet. It was just like, oh, that's another thing that people do in these kinds of practices. And I was like a good witch, I was like tracking the lunation cycles and observing the full moon. And so that's a kind of astrology, but very superficial. And then it was around 2014 that someone who was performing in a piece that I was choreographing, who studied astrology pretty deeply, showed me my chart for the first time. And that unlocked this personal relationship with this tradition. And I started getting more invested in reading. I've always been very autodidactic and gathering a lot of books and trying to find my way through. So I didn't start working with a teacher for the first time until, I guess, I started taking classes with Chani Nicholas around 2016, something like that. Okay. And very quickly, Chani's work led me to the work of Demetra George, who's her teacher and one of the pioneers of working with the goddess Asteroids, and also one of the leaders in transmitting the Hellenistic astrology tradition to us now. And then from being exposed to Hellenistic astrology through Demetra's work, I found my way to Chris Brennan. And so those are my primary teachers. Oh, and then Kelly Surtees, who I now work with. And so my astrology practice was very much rooted early on. As soon as I started taking seriously the study of the tradition, is very rooted in Hellenistic astrology. And so with that, there are these ancient texts that give us these vivid descriptions of the planets and what they signify and how they take on different meaning in different combinations or in different aspects or in different signs and so on. And so those early years was really internalizing a lot of that, seeing how it sat with my own life, reading like, oh, this is what Mercury and Sagittarius in the eighth house means. And then looking at my own life and asking, do I see that? Do I actually see what the book is telling me in my own life? And, or is my life adding to that story in some way? But most important in those early years of the astrology study, I think, was the growing awareness of the ways that what I was seeing in a chart created a context in which a story, my story, if I was looking at my own chart, could be recognized, could be articulated in some way, that the chart and the practice of astrology creates a container, or maybe a container is not the right word, but container or reflection or a description of a story that I already know quite well in some way. And then as soon as I started working with clients, that's where it's like, oh, so these are the things I've been taught. These are the things the books have told me from, 2000 years ago. And then also my teachers about like Venus in Virgo, for example. And then it's like, I'm working with this person and they have their Venus in Virgo. And it means it's shown up in these specific ways in their life, when I talk about what Venus in Virgo could signify, for example, like Venus is said to be in its fall in Virgo. And so these topics of love and desire and pleasure and relationships and beauty that we associate with Venus, there's something perhaps overlooked or misunderstood or ignored or even neglected in some way when Venus is in fall. So what does that look like in someone's life? Well, if I start to talk about those things with someone, they might reflect back to me, well, I've always had relationships with people that maybe haven't been accepted by my family or my society, things like that. Or my sense of beauty is in a direction that isn't necessarily celebrated by the mainstream culture, things like that. And so then I start to have these real tangible lived experiences that substantiate what I'm bringing in terms of some sort of archetypal understanding of the planets and how they operate in particular signs and configurations. Those are some directions that are coming to me. Does that make sense? Does that bring anything up for you?
Yes. Well, interestingly, I have Venus in Virgo. It's funny. Funny you would say that. Yeah. To go with that, the parallel of dance with interpreting and working with tarot and astrology, which I love. And honestly, I can't believe it, but I've never really thought of that before. But, it's a very natural way for me to look at it as well. And I know that you also have a big academic background. And I'm wondering how you feel and where you sit with the idea that we have to kind of learn the rules in order to break them, because I'm also thinking about like classical ballet and how a lot of times in dance, you're told you have to study ballet and then you can, venture off and go into modern and contemporary and those forms are in some ways, break off or a reaction to, classical forms and classical technique. Does that mirror how you have approached astrology? Or do you look at that in a different way? How do you feel about that?
Very interesting question. Well, first, in my dance practice, I did start, in one version of the story, I started in ballet in terms of my training. That's the accurate part of the story. My first dance training was in ballet and very quickly into modern and contemporary. And also that perspective, which I've encountered many, many times that you're describing in terms of like ballet is the foundation and everything else comes from that, is a profoundly Eurocentric and I would venture to say white supremacist perspective of dance.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so my dancing life got much more interesting when I started rooting myself into other traditions I encountered Japanese Butoh in college and that became my central dance practice, still is in many ways. Even when I'm not practicing Butoh specifically, it informs everything I'm doing. And has no roots in ballet. In fact, was formed in the work of Tatsumi Hijikata and Kazuo Ono very much as a reaction, very partially as a reaction to the westernization of Japanese culture. And so there's a resistance inside of that form. In terms of how I've encountered or that same kind of process in astrology or tarot, I guess I'm less concerned or less interested, or I have been, if I look back on my journey, with learning the rules so that I can break them. But I am very invested in knowing where the tradition that I'm practicing is rooted in anything I'm doing. Like in my yoga practice, I'm very clear that this is a 5,000-year-old philosophical tradition, and that this practice of asana and postures is a very recent development in a much, much longer tradition, for example. Like, and so similarly, I think as I was deepening my interest in astrology, I very quickly gravitated to, what are the ancient roots of this tradition? Where did this tradition come from? How did they understand what they were doing in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, and the synthesis of those traditions in the Hellenistic period? And that's where I focused most of my study, not because those were the correct ways or the rules of the tradition, but that's where it came from. Anything else we do with astrology after that point is in some way responding to or deviating from those foundations. And so I like to go back to the root of something, I guess, is part of what I'm discovering in answering this question. Mm-hmm. And similarly with tarot, like tarot, a lot of people's understanding of the history of tarot, actually, you've done some great episodes on the history of tarot, goes back to Rider-Waite Smith, 1909. And it's like, that's not the start of this tradition.
Yes, right.
And so how do we grapple with, I'm quite interested in, and then when I teach tarot, this is part of the story, that tarot very likely began as a card game. It didn't begin as a divinatory tool. And it was several hundred years later that mystics started thinking through and articulating complex systems with which to understand what we're doing in tarot. And I'm interested in that tradition. I'm interested in that lineage and how those stories become woven into what it is we now practice as tarot in the 21st century. And also, I'm quite interested in the fact that there are traces of tarot as a parlor game. What does it mean that in one version, I can't remember the historian who talks about this, but one version of not Trochi specifically, but other games that were played with tarot were people shuffling the deck and laying out cards. And the task was to make up a story on the spot for the cards, for the entertainment of everyone else gathered. Mm-hmm. And I'm so interested in how there's a slide from laying out cards and making up a story for entertainment and celebration and fun, how that slides into what if the cards are telling a story, mm-hmm. and that story is your story, and that there's actually some sort of divine encounter that's at the very least possible in this laying of cards, in this shuffling, this sortilege practice of tarot. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just using that as like one example of like, even with tarot, I'm quite interested in what the roots of the tradition offer us. Not so much like, with tarot, the farther back we go, the more aware we become that of a lot of the quote unquote rules didn't exist at the roots of the tradition. Those rules, whereas astrology is quite different. There are some very, very complex rules at the origins of the tradition. Tarot, there's not that. The rules get built in, even things like the correspondences of the four suits to the four elements, very recent. That's not part of the further tradition of tarot. And in fact, folks like Camelia Elias, who does a lot of work with the Marseille tarot deck, has even like offered other perspectives of what if those particular elemental correspondences to the suits don't actually make sense? Mm-hmm. What if, for example, swords spades is more suited to earth because when we kill people, we bury them, like things like that. Mm. Even that, I'm quite interested in that questioning when we understand the roots of the tradition, which isn't the same thing as learning the rules in order to break them. But that's where that takes me in terms of what can we do with what we learn when we go back to the roots.
Yeah. I love that response. And something that I realized as you were speaking about that, so I just led a course called Restructuring Tarot, and it guided participants to create their own system of mm-hmm. correspondences, sometimes using existing correspondences, sometimes going in totally new directions. But the point was just that if you're going to work with a system, which I don't personally even always feel is necessary, but if you want that, that you should have a personal relationship with that system, you know, and that you should be like opting into that system, you know. And so as you were explaining all of that, it made me realize that a sort of maybe a bigger picture way of even looking at a system of astrology or tarot is just that we encounter the thing. So we, you know, lay out in the field and look up at the stars, or we, you know, play with cards, and then at some point it shifts and we start to feel that the thing is maybe working on us. And then we create a way to interpret that, you know, like, and maybe it's not so much about what the way is, but just that we create a way, you know, and that's the tradition, you know, is maybe a broader way of kind of, you know, looking at that. But you mentioned Camellia Elias, and I want to bring in the quote that you share on your website from them, but then also from yourself. So the Elias quote reads, "A witch is one who poses true questions." And then you write later, "In my practice, shuffling, drawing, and reading cards is a way of being with the questions, welcoming them, considering them affectionately, and speaking with them. We may not be seeking answers in tarot, but rather methods of being with the questions. Rather than putting our questions to rest, the cards put our questions into motion," end quote. And I love that. So I love to question. I've recently started to look at the act of questioning as a devotional kind of offering. You know, if a question is really thought through and really, you know, pure and open in its intent, it feels like an offering, you know, to me. But I would love to hear you just expand on those thoughts a little.
I got quite emotional hearing you read my words back to me. I feel, it's such a weird thing to say. I feel quite seen in those words that I wrote, but this, the feeling of witnessing has to do with your delivery of them. So thank you for that. And yes, the question is central to my practice. It's, you know, after 2 decades of reading tarot, it's exactly that. I think I've come to realize that I'm not actually looking for answers or looking to offer answers when I'm reading tarot for other people. I'm more interested in exploring how we can be with the questions, how we can understand the question that was asked from another perspective. And then that part of keeping the question in motion. Where can we go if we follow the question rather than trying to answer the question? And oftentimes the images on the cards and how they sit alongside one another reveal or address some facet or piece of the question we asked, or why we were asking it that we were not aware of before. And sometimes that raises yet more questions. But either way, I think it invites a dialogue, whether like if I'm working with a client, reading for someone else, actually talking through what that brings up. But also if I'm just reading for myself, a dialogue with myself about what the card is revealing about the question in some way. The cards have a way of offering something like, but what about this? It's like, this is the question I asked. And then the cards say, yes, but what about this? And so then I'm returned to the question in some way. And I mean, even especially with the work that I do with clients, I work in 90-minute sessions, and we will spend probably half the session formulating the question or questions. That to me is part of the divination. It's not like once we start shuffling, now we're doing divination. As soon as we've asked the question, what is my question? And clients will usually talk around like, there's this thing happening in my life and I have these feelings and these things I don't know. And I'm usually just like taking some notes, but also listening deeply. And then I'll start to formulate back and say, so it sounds like you're asking something like, and I'll share some version of the question and they'll say, yeah, yes, that's it. Or they'll say like, it's more like, and offer something else. So we're actually in the process of finding the question before we ever lay the cards. And that to me is a sacred part of that practice. But this quality of keeping the question in motion is perhaps most vivid in my tarot practice when using tarot as movement scores, which is something that I've been practicing and teaching for years now, probably since like, I don't know, 2017, 2018, something like that. And so in this practice, you formulate a question, you ask the question, you shuffle and draw the cards, you lay them out. And then instead of intellectualizing them or verbalizing what you see, or even reaching for the guidebook, you physically move through what you see in the cards, letting what you see shape your movement, the quality of your movement, your gestures, your postures, your transition from one movement to the next as you transition from one card to the next. And especially with people, when I'm sharing that practice with people who aren't dancers, sometimes it's like as simple as if there's a figure in the card, take the posture that that figure is in and then figure out, how did they get here? What led me into this moment? When did the high priestess take the seat, for example, if she's seated in the particular deck that you're working with, because she's not always. and then where does that posture go next? What happens after it? Or like with Rachel Pollack's deck with the Shining Tribe that I read with the most, there are often these like lots of dotted lines and kind of vibrating colors. And so sometimes that's where I'll start, is like this sense of vibrating at the near space beyond the surface of my skin, and see like, what if I take that? And then I, for example, this is all like improvisational in the moment. There's no rules to this, but I take that and it's like, what if I trace the shape of the line that I see in the card with this vibrating body self? What if that is where the question leads me, rather than like, now I then have to interpret the movement that I did in response to the card. It's like, no, the movement is the response. That's an answer, or again, not really answer, but a way of being with the question is in movement. So that phrase in particular, keeping the question in motion, really brings up that practice for me. And it's like, that's true in my tarot practice, but I think it's true in all of my divination. It's like, I think that thing of like keeping it in motion is implicit in astrology, which is built on the movement of planets in time and space. So it's like movement and becoming, like we were talking about earlier, is absolutely implicit in the deep structure of astrology. But I also just started working on a new performance piece, working with bibliomancy, in which audience participants will be invited to ask questions, and then I'll perform bibliomancy using books. Bibliomancy, for people listening, is basically like shuffling or flipping through pages of books and then opening to a quote unquote random page and finding the response to your question on that page. And so I'll perform bibliomancy in response to the questions that are asked, and then move the score I'm working with right now. I just started working on this piece, so it might evolve, is to move in excess of what was articulated in the text. That whatever the text said in response to the question, the movement has a relationship to the text, but it's in excess of the text in some way. And so I'm just sharing that to say, like, this thing of like keeping it in motion seems to be true in all of my divinatory practices, not just tarot.
So I'm glad that you've brought in movement, because I could not have you on the podcast and not talk about a couple of your dance practices specifically. And you mentioned on your website about something that you call dancing body magic and also witch dancing. So will you tell us a little bit about those things?
Yes. They're some of my favorite part of my life. I mean, as you mentioned, as I mentioned some pieces already, like I'm a dancer. I got my BFA in dance and then went on to get a PhD in dance studies. So I've been choreographing and performing all that time. And at some point, it became very important to me to explore the ways that dance can function, yes, as art, but also as ritual and magic and witchcraft and healing. And dancing body magic and witch dancing grew out of that concern, that interest. Dancing body magic came first. It started as a series of workshops that I co-created and facilitated with another artist named Kelly Klein. And I think we did the first one in 2018. And it's an offering that I've continued to develop and share on my own in the years that followed. So it's primarily a workshop format, and it's become a kind of like, I love the language of carrier bag for different practices that we explore. dance, exploring dance and dancing as magical, or dance and dancing as ritual practices, engaging in ritual and divination in embodied ways. And so each one, each workshop, each time I do dancing body magic is a little different, but it draws on this same kind of, yeah, carrier bag or toolbox of practices that can include things like casting circle by doing a walking meditation, or invoking the elements through movement, movement improvisation, moving as the air and fire and water and earth rather than talking about them, dancing with ancestors and the reading the tarot as movement scores, like I mentioned, devising improvised healing rituals using a structure from Valentina Desideri called fake healing that I learned from Keith Hennessy. And then improvised group dances that are also rituals, responding to collective or global crises in immediate communal embodied ways. So those are the kinds of practices that we explore in dancing body magic, and or have been for the last 5 years, I guess. And then witch dancing is more recent. Witch dancing, I started developing in 2020 and then shared for the first time publicly in 2021. And it is what I would call a Butoh-based movement ritual practice. And it came out of, well, a similar kind of convergence or synthesis of having been a dancer and having been a witch for almost 20 years at that point. I started asking the question, what if a dance can be a spell for conjuring our bodies and the worlds in which they live? I would zoom out and say, I actually think all dances do that in some way, that all dances are the creation of some way of being in a world together, whether it's a solo or a group work in relation to the viewers, that always we are organizing social relations and ways of being through choreography. And so then that feels very similar to my magical practice, to witchcraft. And so that was the starting point. And it grew out of this lineage of Butoh, again, from the work of Tatsumi Hijikata and Kazuo Ono, as well as people like Anna Halperin, who's an early postmodern dance pioneer who did a lot with dance as ritual and healing, things that I've learned from Keith Hennessy, my friend, teacher, collaborator, and then also work from Alcestis Demek, who's an occultist and Butoh dancer as well. And I guess in practical terms, witch dancing is an hour-long improvised movement practice guided by a verbal score. And so we move through a series of images and qualities and states, things like embodying the four elements. One of the images is the bedrock of the body quaking and being pulled apart, being filled with vapors emerging from fissures in the earth, and then carried on oracular songs. Shedding skin like a serpent, the joints of the body becoming galaxies, every joint becoming a galaxy, and then the stars of those galaxies becoming a constellation in the sky that pilgrims use to follow and find their way in the night. And then toward the end of the practice, all those stars of the constellation hurtling toward the ground at the end of days. And so as we're moving through these images and qualities, we're cultivating an active and abiding awareness of our felt sense, the full range of sensations that become available moment to moment as the body schema transforms through these different possibilities from image to image. What does it feel like to be the air, to be the fire, to be the water, to be the earth rent apart by tectonic plates shifting, to be the vapors emerging from the earth, to be carried on oracular songs and so on. And I think it's so similar to Dion Fortune, occultist witch Dion Fortune, once said that magic is the art of changing consciousness at will. And I think in this practice, in witch dancing, we exercise that magic in a very embodied way, such that by the end of the practice, we've conjured a new body. We're not the same body we were when we started. And it's through these layers and layers of sensation and awareness and movement that this other body emerges from the witch dancing practice.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like lost in all of everything you just said. I love all of that. The galaxy joints like really had me, but Yeah, I'm wondering, because what I love about everything you're saying is it's, you know, obviously it's embodying all these things. And I do think that sometimes tarot and astrology can get really intellectual and heady. Mm. And something I tend to always really emphasize with my clients with in tarot when we finish is I'll say, you know, okay, now we've done this reading and the cards, you know, have kind of helped some ideas come through, but now like you have to do something with that, you know, that the cards can't change your life, you know, that mm-hmm. you have to take what's come through and actually do something with it. And I do really think that's the kind of the hardest part, you know, for a lot of people. So I'm wondering for you if all of this embodiment was something that came really naturally for you, or if that's something that came over time, you know, how you developed this embodied sense of these concepts.
Oh, beautiful question. Yeah. I mean, the roots of my practice are a tangled constellation of being a dancer and being a witch and reading tarot and coming to my queerness. Like all of that, it's inseparable from one another for me, and developed so entangled with one another along the way. But even in those early years of studying witchcraft, I remember in one of Phyllis Curat's books, I can't remember which one, it's either Book of Shadows or Witchcrafting, but she talks about the body as the altar, that before any sorts of magical tools or correspondences, the body is already right here. This body is air and it is fire and it is water and it is earth and it is goddess. And that had a profound impact on me when I read that as a dancer practicing witchcraft, of like, it's all right here. And so I would say that the body is the site and source of all of this work for me. Astrology, tarot, witchcraft, healing practices, obviously dance and choreography, things like that. And I think the way that I approach it tends to emphasize those things. Like most of, or all, unless someone doesn't want to, it's always optional, but most of my consultations start with an embodied ritual practice to bring us into greater consciousness of our bodies at the start. So that is where the conversation is happening. It's not simply an intellectual exercise, but then like astrology especially is such an embodied tradition. It is literally an interpretation of what we can see in the sky from where we are on Earth. I talk about all the time with clients that the ascendant marks the moment of birth, but it's quite literally where the sky and Earth meet as your body came into the world. Mm. And so before we ever even look at a chart, astrology is about being physically with the sky and going out and seeing the moon changing phases night by night, or seeing when Venus rises or sets, or seeing the constellations, being able to start to recognize the stars and the ways that they've been aggregated together into these mythic stories of the constellation. Like that's before anything else. Astrology is already that kind of embodied practice. And I think some of the most important lessons that astrology can offer happens at that place before we ever look at a chart. Like one of the things I think astrology orients us toward so strongly when we actually go into that embodied observational space of being with the sky is slowness, that nothing in the sky moves as fast as our relentless acceleration of late stage capitalism, nothing. Mm-hmm. And so even just making a practice of going out and looking at how many hours it takes for the sun or the moon or the planets to move from one horizon to the other, even that starts to invite us into a different way of being a body, a different temporality, a slowing down inside of these relentless capitalist systems, and tuning into a way of being in time that predates all of that, that's older and longer and farther and deeper in all directions. So like that embodied sense of time that we get from astrology is, I think, one of the first things it offers us. Mm-hmm. And then also the what we were talking about earlier in terms of the becoming of astrology. Before we ever look at a chart, we can see change in the sky. We can see the planets making their way through their cycles relative to one another, relative to the sun. We can see the change that happens through the seasons as the sun makes its way through the zodiac. We experience that so physically and tangibly and viscerally. And so it's like when we say that the sun is in Aries in the Northern Hemisphere, we mean that we just crossed the equinox and that the weather is going to start getting warmer and the days are getting longer and the sun is more powerful in that sign because the light is overtaking the darkness. Like it's tied, it's intimate, the symbolism is intimately tied to the lived experience of what it means to be on this planet with other planets. And that's maybe another thing that, again, like before we ever look at a chart, astrology is already teaching us or showing us that what it means to be a person is to always have been in relation, to be in relation with the more than human world, the earth and the cosmos, the celestial and the terrestrial, that part of what it means to be a person is composed of those relations, not simply like I'm a person and I think I'm going to build a relationship with Venus. You were always in a relationship. There was never a moment where you were not in a relationship with Venus or Jupiter or Saturn or Mars or Mercury or the moon or the sun. Those planets have always been with every moment of your existence. And so astrology is less, for me, it's less about like creating or building relationships with the planets, with the sky, with the stars, with the asteroids, and more about coming into greater consciousness or awareness that we were always these relations in the first place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And all of that, and I hope this is clear, this is getting back to the embodiment of it. All of that has to do with what it means to be a body on this planet, looking up at the sky. And then we can look at charts and we can make a lot of meaning of it. But all of that happens after these foundational orientations that astrology gives us to slowness and change and relationality. That comes from being a body, looking at the night sky, looking at the day, the sky at by day. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. Yes. Beautiful. Beautifully said. And you know, I actually was realizing that it's kind of very tender for people. Or I could see how it can be because, you know, people often come to astrology and tarot in difficult moments, you know, and myself included. Like I came to these modalities, you know, in really hard times. And then, so then to be told like, well, actually you have to stay with yourself, you know, like actually it is your body. It is your experience. Is kind of tender, I think, you know, actually, mm-hmm. because you might be actually wanting to escape, you know, you might prefer to lose yourself in studies or, you know, kind of, reach out, you know, but, it's reminding me of something I feel really strongly about now with tarot, which is, you know, if you're going to learn tarot, really what you have to do is learn about yourself and about life. I mean, that's what reading tarot is, you know, and to be a good tarot reader, you have to be a student of life, really, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess I've never really thought about how tender that realization might actually be for people of like, oh, wow, it's me. I have to just be here with myself. I mean, and that's just like every other lesson, you know, it always comes back to ourselves, but that is really, you know, poignant.
I think so too. I think you're right to attenuate to the tenderness of that. Because at least in my work, at least the way that I share these offerings with people, we're never trying to escape. It's always, I mean, even what you said at the very beginning of commenting on how present I was with the question of who and where are you now? It's like, I think that's what all of this work is orienting toward, is being able to be present with who and where and how you are in all of the ways, in all of the sensation, in all of the emotion, in all of the trauma, like all the things that come with what it means to be present. And I agree. I think there's an intense aversion to that that's in no small way impacted by deeply, I can't quite find the language, but being in cultures that despise the body, that we are, the body is subjugated to the mind or the intellect or even the spirit or soul in so many ways. So much of our culture orients us towards things outside of ourselves, outside of our body, our screens, for example, but also just like the ubiquity of text and image and all the ways we're pulled out of sensation and the felt awareness of the body. And so like definitely in terms of my dance and somatic work, I think it's a big focus of what it is I think I'm here to do is to facilitate more of an awareness of the body that we are. And I think that tarot and astrology are practices that for me have never not been part of that, that in so many ways, in so many stories that I could share, the ways that astrology and tarot bring us back to ourselves. And part of what it means to come back to ourselves is to come back to what it means to be a body experiencing this full range of existence. And sometimes that doesn't mean being with the hard things. Like one of the courses that I TA with Kelly Surtees is about how do we talk about challenging aspects in the chart? Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes when people come, they're looking for a way out of what's challenging. They're looking for a way to get out of it or avoid it. Like they see it coming. They see this hard transit coming, their Pluto to their moon or something. They're like, yes. I don't want to do that. And I, again and again in that course and with the students that I work with in that course, just try to remind us all that when we look back, when most of us look back over our lives and try to identify what have been some of the most meaningful experiences of our lives, some of those were also the most challenging. Mm-hmm. I don't think the point of astrology, seeing the hard transit or the difficult progression coming up or turning over the tower in tarot, like, I don't think the point of this is so that we can avoid it. I think it's like being with the question, these are practices, tools, and traditions that allow us to be with what comes, what's happening, including some of the most difficult moments of our lives that make us who we are. Like, and I think about that in terms of being a queer person, being a gender non-conforming, gender queer, non-binary person, trans person. Nothing about that's particularly easy in the world that we're living in, especially this moment with over 400 pieces of anti-LGBTQ legislation being introduced and debated and adopted into law in the United States. And yet, does that mean it's like, well, then we don't want people to be queer. We don't want people to be trans. No, of course not. So the challenge, the difficulty is part of these profoundly meaningful parts of what it means to be who we are or who we're becoming in some way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well said. Yeah. So this has been a beautiful conversation. Thank you so, so much. I'm going to finish with a question that I ask all of my guests at the end, which is, you know, the podcast is called In Search of Tarot, and I would love to hear a little bit about what you might be in search of right now in your own life.
I think for a long time, I've told people that my purpose in this life is to co-create meaningful shared experiences with others. And I think that's something that I'm always in search of, always seeking, always cultivating and pursuing and celebrating. And I don't know, I think life is very good right now. In fact, I've said more times this, a few times this week to loved ones, that it feels like my life is better than it ever has been. Mm. And so when I sit with this question of what am I in search of, my first thought is like, nothing, it's all here or something like that. But what's coming up for me is like, to respond to the question, what am I in search of? I'm in search of right now. Mm. There are so many ways in which the life I'm living is so full and rich and satisfying. So I'm in search of what we're just talking about, being present for all of this connection and love and meaningful experience and this conversation with you right now. And the stars just starting to become visible after the sun sets. Like, I'm in search of this moment. And if I sit with that question a little longer, I do feel the grief and the rage of political despair. at what we're living through right now in terms of the relentless legislative assault on LGBTQ people, especially trans people in the US. And so I think I'm also in search of the worlds that we are already creating with and for one another, despite whatever politicians do or try to suppress or eradicate us. It's like, we are already in practices like this of being with one another in ways that hold each other with tenderness and care and creativity and support our flourishing, regardless of politicians and right-wing extremists. So it's like, so I guess I'm in search of those spaces of refuge and spaces of sanctuary where we can flourish with one another. And we're already doing that. We're already creating those worlds. We're doing it in this conversation. We're doing it in our clubs and our bars and our dance studios and our covens and our parks and all of the ways we, our beds and all of the ways we are creating the worlds that allow us to live well despite the political circumstances.
Well, you know, this episode won't come out for a couple of months, and so I just want to say that I'm honored to sit with you in this moment of happiness for you, because I know that those moments, you know, they don't last forever, just like everything else. And so it's really nice to be in that place with you. And I'm grateful to find myself in a similar position right now. So it's nice to land here with you for just a moment, you know.
And be in this joy. And to know, like, I mean, this gets back to the embodiment a little bit, but to know that this joy continues to live with us in our bodies as a felt state, even when we are also confronting despair and grief and rage and all the other things that life brings us, that this continues to be a resource with and for ourselves across nonlinear time in some way.
Well, Michael, tell people how they can find you and follow you and work with you, because I know anyone who's listened to this conversation is going to want to do that. So let them know how they can.
Thanks. That's so sweet. The best way is my website, which is michaeljmorris.co. You can also find me on social media, on Instagram. I am at @cowitchcraftofferings. On Twitter, I am at Morris Michael J, although I'm not super active on Twitter right now because Twitter is capsizing. So not the best place to find me, but it is a thing that's out there. But my website, Instagram, those are the great places. If people want to work with me, probably when this comes out, I will not have sessions available because they're almost all full right now. So the best thing at that point is to, on my website, to just get on the mailing list. I send out mailing list newsletters about 4 times a year announcing my books are open. So if you want to work with me, now's the time. And so that's the best way, is to just get on the mailing list to know when that happens. It's not astrology or tarot specific, but I guess the only other thing I have coming up is that I am presenting, or I'm speaking at, an ecosexuality symposium in New York in June. Which is June 16th, 17th, and 18th. And I have been asked to talk about queer astrology and ecosexuality together. And I'm quite excited about that and thinking about it in through a framework of kinship. And so that's something, if people are in New York, that they can look that up. It's at Performance Space New York is where it'll be happening. And so if people just look up performancespacenewyork.org, they can find information about this symposium, which is called Exploring the Earth as Lover, Assuming the Ecosexual Position, and is being curated and produced by Beth Stevens and Annie Sprinkle.
Amazing. And that will be in-person only, not virtual?
No idea. I'm almost positive it's in-person only, but no idea.
I was hoping
Nothing on the website that suggests that there's going to be some Zoom options.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I was hoping there would be, because that sounds really fascinating, but... All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. And I've just loved every moment of this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nick. It's been a delight.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's birdgerhl_. And you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.